Hi, friends. So season 6 of the Faith and Imagination podcast is now in the books. Thank you for joining us as we tie a bow on some highlights from the past several episodes. As you probably know, we run our podcast seasons on the school year calendar, usually early September through late spring at some point. And in these wrap-up episodes, the producers and I share a few of the many things we loved about our conversations with this past season's group of extraordinary guests. And this year, I'm going to give the floor more or less to Kate Thorpe, our producer, to share some of the moments that have stood out to her. Now, before we get to Kate's highlights, I thought the two of us, Kate and I, would hold a brief conversation. So Kate, whenever anyone listens to this episode of the podcast, they're listening to your work, right? The podcast would not exist without Kate Thorpe. Can you give our listeners a quick introduction as to who you are? I'm interested, you know, where are you from? What are you studying? What brought you to become the producer of the podcast?
Okay, well, I'm from Seattle, Washington, but my family lives a couple miles up the road in Lehi. I'm an American studies minor, so I learn about religious lives and liberties. And most importantly, I'm an English major, and
that's
I
right.
study literary studies.
Yes.
I came to this podcast because I took your class that semester on poetics of faith, and I learned a lot about that. And I got to meet Starley, your old podcast producer, and I got to learn a little bit more from her. And so when the opportunity came around, I was like, I had to jump on it because I wanted to learn more about some of the people you taught and mentioned in class and some of the work that you do.
I appreciate that. I've got to add too, you and another student and a friend of yours and mine, Henry Purser, were assistants last year in a couple of events I had to host. Not had to host, I was able to host, privileged to host last year at BYU. And you guys were fantastic at that. They're really capable. I mean, Kate's amazing. So when you were available to host them, I thought, this is great. I already know Kate's great. So thank you a ton for what you've done this year. I've got to ask you, though, about this other thing. So you were a student of mine before, as you mentioned, before you were the producer of the podcast. And once in a while, I'd put onto our course syllabus, a schedule of readings, a link to one of the episodes. Usually it's because we were reading somebody who had happened to speak with on the podcast, and I put the link there. Now that you've produced the podcast also, what's the difference between listening to it and producing it for you? The key difference would be what, if there is one?
I guess the key difference is I have a greater appreciation for the conversations and the guests that we have here on the podcast because I get to listen to them multiple times. Before, when I was just a listener, I was trying to figure out how this could relate to what we were talking about in class or like how it could relate to my personal life. The producing part is the fun part because I get to listen for myself, but then I also get to listen for our listeners. Mm. So when we're having the conversations here and we're just recording, I sit and I listen to like, what are some of the parts of the conversation that stood out most to me? What were some fun parts that I get to experience with you and the guest? And like conversations like the one that we had with Mina Cho, I get to sit there and I'll be like, yeah, like this is great. And I get to hear a little bit more of the preparation side. But when I go back and listen to it while I'm editing, I get to put myself in the shoes of the listeners and think, okay, what are people going to get out of this? I already know what I'm going to get out of this. What are they going to get out of this? And I'm always listening and looking for like the little sound bites, like what part of this conversation makes this conversation, what sets it apart from the rest. And when I do that, it's a different experience because I'm thinking not only about myself, but I get to think about all of our listeners. And so sometimes the same things stick out to me. Most of the times they don't, because I always keep notes while I'm first listening to the conversation, but then when I'm listening again, those notes never actually align up with what I choose, because it's just a different experience listening versus producing because of the people that I think it's most important for.
Yeah, you've got to do like it's a case of super heightened and sustained attention when you're producing this kind of thing. Yeah, and which would be a bit uncanny because you've got to have heard like about this season probably 45 mistakes I've made in the course of it. It's just how it works, you know. So if I produced it, I'm sure I would drive myself crazy. So anyway, thank you. You're doing a great job, Kate.
Yeah. Matt, I wanted to ask you, now that we're wrapping up this season, what have been some of your favorite moments from the season?
That's a great question. And in past years, what I've done, I've talked with producers, we've kind of chosen moments, each of us, and gone over them. I've got to say, though, I'm gonna fudge my answer this one. There are lots of those moments, but what really stands out to me really are the extraordinary guests, the people with whom I am so blessed to speak. Right? So, for example, just going back to the beginning of the season, I was blown away by Darren Middleton's eloquence in speaking about the relationship of faith and skepticism. Preparing to talk with Khaled Keith Perry, I read a couple of books he'd written on theopoetics. It taught me so much about theopoetics. It was a gift to me. Emma Mason's current scholarship on Catholic mystic women of the early 20th century. It's just about the coolest academic project I've come across this year. It was amazing to me. And then I was honored to talk to Karen Swallow Pryor, who's this extraordinary public intellectual in the Christian space, and so on. I won't list all the guests, but it's just to say that what makes the podcast amazing are these people. It's a gift to be able to speak with them. It really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it makes all of these people that we read about real. That's one thing that I've loved about producing it. And then I guess I want to ask you, now that you've done the podcast for a while, how have you seen yourself change, your spiritual life change, your thought process change while talking with some of these people?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, seeing myself change, I'm getting a lot older. So yeah, let's start there, right? You know, funny, coincidentally, I've gotten grayer doing the podcast. But it's not because of the podcast, I'm getting grayer. No, you know, that's a great question. I began the podcast during COVID, right? Because I was directing the Humanities Center. All of our big programming, for the most part, got shut down. We could have occasional guests come in on Zoom. But, you know, only so much you can do with, like, Zoom lectures before you're just sick of it. And we were all, I'm grateful for Zoom, grateful for it, but also tired of that format. So we thought, why not do something a bit different, start a podcast? And we didn't quite know what we were doing at the outset, but we just kind of followed kind of instincts, and it became such this affordance of riches. You know, I love God. I love speaking with people about their experience of God, which is the substance of the Christian spiritual life. This really is not a podcast about religion per se. It's a podcast where people who are religious people discuss what unifies them across religious differences. And that unity is found really in the Christian spiritual life. And I suppose part of how I would be different now than I was when this began is that I just, you know, as a person who tries to live a life in keeping with my religious and spiritual values, I hope that I'm a better version of myself. But I have been blessed so many times over by the incredible insights of these guests. I mean, speaking about a few more people we talked to just this season, I mean, talking with Paul Pastor about poetry and his relationship with faith, that changes how I think, not just about poetry, but about the nature of faith and why poetry is such a great medium for exploring the limits and the depths of faith. Or talking about Mina Cho, you mentioned her, right, about the silence of God. I don't know how you talk with someone like that who's so thoughtful, and how you come away with that not having some new reflection on your own relationship with God. Or learning from Jason Crawford, right?
Yeah.
About the connection between sainthood and modern comedy. I tell you, I do not look at comics the same way, or saints for that matter, right? So all these things act on me. And it's the ideas of the guests, but it's also in a lot of ways just the example and the genuineness and the goodness of the guests. It makes me want to be a better person. It's made me more open about my faith, frankly. When I began this, I thought, in the humanities, no one talks about faith because you know, the secular humanities. And now I love talking with that very thing about with people, and it's made me more open about trying to be a better human. So am I being a better human? I don't know. I mean, probably not, but I'm trying. I'm trying.
Yeah, the Lord rewards effort.
Yeah, for sure. Kate, I've got to thank you for your extraordinary work you've done this season. Here's where I'm going to sign off now, right, and leave the episode to you, and you're going to identify a few exchanges that stood out to you this season for reasons that you will then explain. So I look forward to hearing this episode when you got it produced. I'm curious what you're going to pick out. But just one more word of thanks, Kate, for your exceptional work and for your grace, not only in how you work with the machinery, but how you work with me and our guests. You've been terrific.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure working on this podcast. It's so fun.
So good luck.
Thank you. We'll see what I choose. When Matt first asked me to prepare this episode and to share three or four moments throughout the season that are like my highlights and share my thoughts on them, I was really excited because I'm grateful for the opportunity to do this and to talk to our listeners, but I didn't realize how hard it would be to do this because of how many wonderful guests we had and all the amazing things they had to say about each one of their topics or books, and it was really hard for me to just narrow it down to four moments that really stuck with me, because there are so many that stuck with me. There are some that unfortunately I didn't get to include today, but I still talk about with friends, colleagues every single day. Like just this past week, I was talking about one of our episodes with Jason Crawford and his book, and there are just so many things, all of the people I got to meet, and it's just so much fun to listen to them talk about what they're passionate about and some of the experiences they've had in their various fields of study. But I am really excited to present today four of my highlights for the season and to give some of my thoughts and insights. So I decided to go in chronological order, and so we're going to start with the episode with Emma Mason when she was talking about her project of women mythics. And I picked this episode, or at least this moment in the episode, because last summer when I was working with Matt on some of his projects that he had going on here at BYU, I actually got to meet Emma in person, and I didn't get to hear much about her project because I was in and out during her presentation. The little things I heard in that time really caught my attention. So when I heard that she was coming on the podcast for this season, I was really excited to hear more about her project and to like listen to the conversation that her and Matt were having about some of the women she talked about. And so it's a wonderful episode. There's so many great things, and it was really hard to just pick one moment, but I decided to pick a moment from the end of the episode. And yeah, I'll just play it for you.
So let me close with a couple sets of questions, then kind of conclusion here I want to ask you. The first, you know, as you thought about it, is there a lesson or two that we could take from these remarkable 20th century Catholic mystics, Edith Stein and Rachel Maritain and others you're writing about? Is there a reason why they seem especially relevant now? Or is the value of this project for you rooted more in the desire to ensure that they aren't just forgotten?
I think they're really relevant now. I don't think it's just a reclamation project, although part of it is that. I think that their relevance is in shifting our understanding of passionate feeling about God. So for example, one of the images that often gets used when we think about mysticism is the Bernini altarpiece of St. Teresa, where she's in this kind of ecstasy. It's a kind of passionate and raw sort of jouissance. I think that Stein would say, you know, that isn't really what mysticism is. I mean, she talks about it, and again, this is another quote from Stein. She talks about it as being, quote, weighted down and settled in the cell. And, you know, I love the Bernini sculpture, of course, but I think there is possibly a different perspective coming here from women who want to say, you know, this mysticism is like a soft ecstasy. It's like a kind of feeling okay. There is a sort of meditative, you know, almost Zen-like, but within the frame of the Catholic Church, again, a bit like the kind of work Thomas Merton was doing. You know, I think that hope for a state of being okay is really important in a world where a lot of people don't feel okay. And a lot of people aren't okay for very material reasons, but a lot of people that are kind of materially sort of all right are also not okay.
Amen to that.
I chose this clip because I really like what Emma says about it being a soft ecstasy compared to the grand ecstasy that we all think of when we think of the sculpture from Bernini that she was talking about. And I really liked the quote that she shared about being weighted down, because sometimes we are just seeking to be okay. And I think that the way that she put it is a perfect way to feel, or is a perfect way to say kind of how I see people around me feeling. Like, there are a lot of people that struggle with things that we don't know about. So many of my friends, people that I love, family, and there's just so much that we don't share, and it's all personal and it's all internal. And this relationship, having a relationship with God in a way that makes it so when we're not, like she says, we're not materially okay, or even if we are materially okay, sometimes we're not spiritually okay, or sometimes we're not emotionally okay or mentally okay. And I think that that's a very interesting way of putting it, because the practice of mysticism and the things that these women are experiencing can be a way to get us towards the being okay and healing us in a way that sometimes we don't know that we need to be healed. I thought the whole episode with Emma is fantastic, but I do really believe that some of the things that these women experienced and wrote about, now that Emma is compiling and preparing to write a book about it, I think it is something that anyone can benefit from today. And I think that Matt's question about, like, is this applicable to, like, today, and Emma's comment and response, I think is a perfect response to that, because it's true. Sometimes we are searching to be okay. And I do think that that's an answer, especially for people my age, college students, young adults, but everybody, everyone experiences something different. My problems are different than my parents' problems and my professor's problems and my siblings' problems. But we are trying, and we're just seeking to be okay. And we're trying to heal something that can only be healed by God, Jesus Christ, and through our own spiritual experiences. And so I just am really fascinated by some of the things that Emma is studying and the things that she's talking about and she's sharing. And it really has opened my eyes to some of the things that I knew about through my own personal experience, but I'd never been able to express it. And now I'm learning so much more about some of the people who made this possible. So the next episode that really touched me was the episode with Katie Kresser. Katie was the BYU Faith and Imagination guest this year. When she was here, we got to talk before the episode. I got to attend her lecture, and then we also got to go out to dinner with some of the other people here at BYU and just have more conversations. And I had a really fun time getting to know her and talking more about her experience. Just like, she lives in Seattle, I grew up in Seattle, so we got to bond over that. But some of the things that she said in her episode really stuck with me and made me think a little bit more about spirituality, like spiritual life, and outside of what's written on a page. Because as an English student studying literature, I focus mainly on the words, but it was very interesting to hear her talk about art, and especially architecture, because she talks about cathedrals and all the different kinds of experiences while she was in Rome, experiencing just like the rich history they have there, the art that they have there, and then just her experience. And so I want to share one little piece that she said.
Do you see in your own religious life that you feel like you are in some kind of at least sense of God's presence, such that you may be asked to do things? Or that you ask God in turn to do things?
Yeah, no, I think that's the goal. Like, I mean, for me, I would say my subjective experience of my faith is that I know God is out there. I know God's the best. I want to be someone who can fully receive what he has to tell me and what he has to ask of me. There are barriers in my life that prevent me from fully receiving that. And those barriers could be trauma. They could be deprivation, kind of things I described before. They could be situations that I'm in. That might not be the best situations. You know, I think that, you know, we can make choices and put ourselves in situations where we block ourselves to, I suppose, divine communication, to intimacy with the divine, because it's like oil and water. Like, there are some things we can choose to do in our lives that the holy can't mix with, right? And so if we're in some of those situations, the divine's going to have a little bit of trouble making contact with us, I suppose. So I think for me, I think for my Christian life is one that is trying to find and remove barriers to communion with the divine. And the goal is constant, you know, accompaniment by the divine. That's the goal. And if something enters in that seems to be creating a barrier, it has to be identified and removed. And I think that's how I would characterize my spiritual life, actually, is, yeah, finding those barriers, removing them, and then trying to have kind of perfect openness to however God would want to guide me.
I love that. Mm-hmm. And that rings true to me. I know that if you're not, I mean, religion minus a sense of the divine or a sense of God's presence is, I don't quite understand it.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I really don't. Uh-huh. In my case, I know that the kind of the imperfect openness that I feel I have is just my own. It could come from my behaviors. I mean, if I'm not acting as I should, right? Mm-hmm. That's a barrier. Mm-hmm. Or it could just be my own mortal limitation. I'm not, I'm learning, evolving, growing, learning how to open myself more. But I feel like in my own spiritual life, I'm prompted or impressed to do things that are difficult that I'd rather not do all the time. Mm-hmm. But also given the enormous, I feel, best word for it is blessings as a function of the things that I receive, right, from God. So what you say, I think, is very articulate, but also I think it really resonates. Mm-hmm. I think for me, certainly, and for a lot of religious people, which I really appreciate.
I really liked what Katie said here about barriers getting in the way of her connection with the divine, because I've definitely seen that in my life. And there's, just like Matt, I served a mission for our church, and I was in Brazil for 18 months. My mission's a little bit shorter than his was, but on a mission, missionaries are required to get rid of all barriers that stop them from connecting with the divine. That makes it so that they do have God as a constant companion in their lives. And it is a wonderful time to have that deep connection with God, but it makes it harder for us who've come home now to find that same connection when the barriers are back. As a missionary, we don't have social media in the same sense that I have social media now. We don't have access to the same music. We aren't watching movies. We're not watching TV shows. Our day is dedicated to serving God and helping other people come closer to God. And it makes it easier to be closer to God, because my whole purpose for 18 months of my life was to help others come into Christ. But it makes it harder when you come home to think, wow, there was a period of my life when this was so much easier than it is now. And I just deeply resonated with what Katie was saying about trying to find those barriers and take them out of our lives. And like, there are things that I struggle with, like social media being one of them, just sitting on my phone and scrolling through or comparing myself with others, that puts a barrier in between understanding my divine worth, but also understanding my relationship with God. Because instead of exploring God's creations, like going being outside and enjoying nature, or not saying I need to read my scriptures 24 hours a day, but studying the lives of people in the Bible or growing my knowledge just in general. That's a divine pursuit for a lot of people, but doing things that will help me grow and progress as a person, I'm sitting and I'm watching silly little videos on Instagram, or I'm comparing myself to people in my life or people not even in my life who just pop up on my Facebook feed, and I'm dwelling on that instead of dwelling on something that can make me better and that brings me closer to God. And so I really loved how she said that her spiritual life is one that identifies the barriers and takes them out, and by that she comes closer to God, and she is trying to find ways to strengthen her relationship with the divine. And I think that that is a good way to think about all of our spiritual lives and to contemplate on the things that are right in front of us. There are so many good ways to strengthen a relationship with the divine that are right in front of us, right outside our front doors. But we're, especially me, I'm finding an excuse of, oh, I don't need to go outside right now. It's 100 degrees. I don't want to walk outside. But I'm taking away opportunities for me to feel closer to the divine. But I do feel that when I am doing those things that help me get closer to God, help me get closer to Jesus Christ and strengthen my spiritual life, I am happier and I'm better. I'm getting more on that path to being okay, just like Emma talked about. The next one that I want to share is from the episode with Paul Pastor. We did a highlight episode of Paul Pastor last season, and then he was back with us this season. And so I am very grateful that I've gotten to listen to Paul before I was even the producer here. There are so many things that Paul said in his episode and shared about his book, The Locust Years, that I was deeply touched by. And I think in my way, in my life, poetry has become one of the ways for me to understand things that are going on in my own life in ways that I have never before, because I've never had the vocabulary or I've never had the ability to express, but I can recognize it in other people's writing. And so listening to him, to Paul and Matt talk about the locust years and some of the poems that they discussed in the episode were ones that really stuck with me. But I decided to choose the little part of the conversation when Matt and Paul are talking about the preface to the book. And so I'll just go ahead and play it.
That's terrific. Okay, so let me ask you then about the preface to The Locust Years. And by the way, I can fully see your poetry being collected. Certainly it'll be anthologized, and I'm looking forward to seeing that when it comes out. But you write a preface to The Locust Years, and you title it cleverly Letter from Paul, so it's a kind of a new Pauline epistle, right?
It's got epistle, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And in it, you mention writing the poems in this collection during the years of the pandemic, and which you acknowledge were obviously a difficult time for many, many people, right? And you write in the collection that real hope is painful. And you mentioned this the collection's about kind of recovery, you know, of hope. And then you mentioned also that to hope is to risk disappointment, and that if the hope is large enough, it even means to risk despair.
Yeah.
I found that provocative. Do you feel that you risk despair as a poet, or do you consider your poetry a response or remedy to such despair?
Yeah, I feel we risk despair just by living, like by being a person, like that's the risk of despair. So is poetry a response or a remedy? Yeah, it can be. sometimes, you know, sometimes it exacerbates despair. Totally honestly, it just depends on the poet. What is coming out of your life? Like, poetry should be the expression of what's happening inside. It's like, you know, I use images of a cider press often, or of a distillation. It's like poetry is the sweet liquor that comes when you're really squeezed and you're really pressed. It's the good stuff. It's distilled. But it's coming out of the product of a human life, of a human soul, if it's good. So is it a response or a remedy? Well, maybe metaphorically, it's what comes when despair presses you, or when whatever the thing you're wrestling with is pressing you. So the Locust Years really is about the folly of hope, the impossibility of hope. And yet that's completely paradoxical. There's multiple stories from the Christian scriptures where God is doing something amazing and people laugh. Like, the response is laughter, not from mockery, but I think it's a self-protective laugh. I'm afraid to believe that this little girl who just died can be raised to life again, even though Jesus is saying she's just sleeping. So of course I'm going to laugh, because that is so much safer than belief or than hope, and when my heart is so involved. And that's the dilemma at the core of the title, The Locust Years. God says, you know, I will restore to you the years that the locusts have eaten. What? Like, okay, that sounds great, but really? No, I can deal with them being gone, but I can't deal with the hope that you're saying you're going to give me back something that was taken. It's easier for me to just not hope. I choose to reject that and say, I'm not going to laugh at that promise. I'm going to try to believe that promise, but that's hard. That's a risk. And because some things are so close to our heart, they'll either disappoint us or they will place us in despair. But that's the leap. That's the work of faith. That's the invitation. And it strikes me that, you know, Christ doesn't ask us to do anything here that he did not do himself. On Holy Saturday, he laid in the sleep of death and surrendered completely to that, with the belief that his Father would raise him again by the Holy Spirit. But that was an act of faith. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to wax too eloquent on this, but I think that poetry is a response to despair. And whether or not that poetry is able to offer us spiritual resources in the middle of it just largely depends on our ability to be courageous and to fully embrace the difficulty and the joy of being a human.
I really liked what Paul said here about faith and hope and belief, and especially the part where he says, I'm not going to laugh at that promise. I'm going to believe in that promise. Because I agree with him, and he admits it, that doing that is hard. And choosing to believe, choosing to hope, choosing to have faith is so much harder than choosing to not have faith, to not have hope, and to not believe in the things that God is capable of doing. And especially the part where he reminds us that Jesus Christ doesn't ask us to do anything that he hasn't already done when he was here on this earth. And I think of that all the time, especially when I'm asked to do hard things. And I really like just the way that Paul puts it. I don't want to just keep talking, because I think he put it in a very perfect way. But I think his decision to choose to believe and to choose to do the hard thing, to choose hope and faith, is a great way to live and to strengthen our spiritual lives. For my last clip, I decided to choose Matt's conversation with Mina Cho. I chose this clip because even before the conversation Matt and Mina had, I was practicing silence in my own life and trying to figure out ways that I can invite silence in, because there have always been moments in my life where silence is easier, but there are always moments where silence is hard. And it's in those moments of stress and being overwhelmed, anxiety, that silence is particularly hard, because I don't want to be alone with my thoughts, or there's something else that I want to be distracting myself with, but it's in those moments where I need it the most, especially in moments where silence is a way to help connect myself with God. And so I really loved the conversation he had with Mina, and I'm just going to share a few minutes that really touched me.
Let me ask about this. At the beginning of the first chapter of your book, you clarify, I'm quoting you here, that silence is not simply the absence of sound or speech. Rather, silence is a particular type of presence, which I found provocative. Can you explain what you mean when you describe silence as a type of presence?
Sure. In that sense of silence as a presence is based on my own experience of prayer. When I say silence is a type of presence, I think I am kind of pushing back against, you know, the assumption that silence equals absence or the lack of speech or sound. And that assumption, I guess, is just everywhere in our politics, in our worship, and even in, you know, much of our theology. And I think maybe one of the useful analogies for silence is the presence of absence is music. So the pause and the rest between notes are not deficiencies of sound. If you remove them and you do not get music, it's just, you know, full of noise. And I think also something similar is true of space. So I use space as a metaphor for silence in the book. Because space, too, is not mere emptiness, right? Space is what allows presence to appear and to breathe and to become sometimes, you know, relational. So a room is not meaningful only because of the objects, you know, placed inside it. It is meaningful because there is a space between them. So, yeah, silence is a space. You know, I'm trying to say that, you know, divine presence, the presence of God may not always come as fully spectacular or sound or certainty. And sometimes the divine presence as, you know, kind of the vast spaciousness, you know, the clearing and the embracing that have us within it. It's not empty, but it's kind of openness that allows us to be present.
I like that distinction a lot. I like that idea about evoking space as a kind of a way to think about silence. There are certainly people are familiar with spaces in which silence prevails, like a lot of religious sanctuaries, right, are spaces of quiet and silence, and they're not anything but empty, right? And if you feel there a sense of the holy or the sacred or the presence of God, it's not an empty feeling. There's a fullness to it, but it's a fullness that almost creates a response, a kind of reflexive response of kind of a hushed, a stillness, a deeper listening.
I love this conversation that Matt and Mina had about spaces of silence and just silence in general, because I've just seen a huge shift in my life when I've started to practice silence and to invite silence into my life, because it's helped me work through things in ways that I could not have done in any other way, because it allows me to sit and to slow down instead of just constantly moving and constantly searching for answers. But it also gives me peace when those answers don't come, because instead of worrying when my questions are not being answered right away, I can appreciate the moment of silence, because it is in those silences that we grow, or at least I grow, and I learn more about myself and about my relationship with God. I really liked what Mina talked about in this episode and just some of the things that she studies and the things that she writes about. And I really appreciate all of the guests that we've had on this podcast this season, because they've helped me realize that there are so many other ways to deepen my connection with God through silence, through art, through taking barriers out of my life, through choosing to believe, through learning to be okay and getting on the path to being okay. And it's been so great to work with Matt and all of our wonderful guests. And I can't wait for another season of it. So thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Kate Thorpe. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.